There you are. No, I just wanted to make sure that you folks were still in the room before we started. All right, we are reconvening now. We still have our quorum. We would like to, even though everyone used up his or her time, we would like to provide the opportunity for each of the parties to use, if you wish, up to 5 minutes to ask questions of either the other parties or the staff.
And or to make a closing statement.
And or to make a closing statement. Thank you. And or to make a closing statement. We hope you don't use all 5 minutes, but here we are. And is there a recommended order of what we should?
Certainly up to you, but it's probably reasonable to do the same order that we did the initial presentations.
Okay, let's offer the opportunity to the staff first to ask any questions that you want and or make a closing statement.
I think for the record, we'd just like to make some closing statements here just to maybe possibly clarify some issues that were presented before you. Just to begin with, I guess, and based on our experience on overseeing many different types of sites over the years, we never have all the data that we really need. And here is just another example, even though there have been, you know, a number of investigations so far. So we need to go forward with the data that we do have in hand. And that's what we have presented and have put forward in terms of our ideas about the scenario in terms of the PCE migration out there. And notably, there are a number of different scenarios that can be presented, but we tried to move forward with what we felt was simplest and most straightforward and commonly accepted, both within the literature and things like the Santa Clara dry cleaner study that's out there, and what's generally assumed to be groundwater conditions historically over time within the Santa Clara Valley Basin. So we don't believe we're putting forward any new evidence, but really working with information that we all have a general working knowledge about. And we think that that information is sufficient to show that there was a discharge that took place in the early period at the site when UATC did indeed have ownership. And we base that not only on the fact that there was a dry cleaner facility there during that period of time, but there was specific equipment that was used during that period of time which is known to cause leaks. And in addition, we have evidence that is indeed what was used at that period of time. And it's also common knowledge that the dry cleaner equipment that was used early on in the 60s was more prone to leakage than the equipment that was used much later on. And that's mainly because, as was discussed, it was an open system where there was a lot of transfer back and forth and a lot of potential for spillage that was inherent within that equipment. You've heard some discussions about changes in groundwater gradients, and there's a lot of different ways to kind of parse that out. But basically, we believe that that is not particularly relevant in this situation because of the depth to groundwater being far enough below the release site that it didn't make that much of a difference here. So the basic information that we're working from is the high indoor air concentrations directly beneath the facility, which is driving our decision making. You also saw a map that was illustrating a potential second plume out there related to the sewer system. We do not believe that there is sufficient information to point directly to the city's operation of that sewer system and or that sewer pipe being a discharge point. You saw different maps that had different contours drawn in terms of that, but there's clearly a lack of information about that area, and there's a number of other plausible scenarios that need to be investigated in relation to that. Certainly, transport can take place through the conduits around the sewer lines, the gravel-packed trenches in which the sewer lines are in. There could be other plumes that are nearby. There's lots of questions that come up in relation to that area, in addition to just simple migration of the shallow groundwater, where you've heard debate about how uncertain that may be in terms of the direction. So the bottom line for us is that there's clear evidence underneath the facility of a release of the constituents that were used there, and that is the basis of our recommendation. You also heard, you know, sort of a geochemical argument that was presented in terms of DNAPL out there and whether it was or was not present. Again, we think the fact that, and again, consistent with the Santa Clara Valley Dry Cleaner Study report, we don't need the presence of DNAPL to illustrate the fact that there was indeed a release that took place a long time ago. We have those high air concentrations. Volatilization of DNAPL can lead to high indoor air concentrations. So we do not agree with the geochemical argument that was put forward as well, indicating that there was a more recent release than what we're seeing. And I think, actually, since I'm almost out of time, I think I will conclude with that, unless you have any specific questions for us.
No questions. All right. We're going to give the United Artists the option to go next.
Can you hear me now? Scott Reich for United Artists. Just one thing I wanted to start with, which is this objection we raised before, I want to just repeat about the production well data. Question, response D12 the board material says, according to this data and the SEVWD production well data, only deep groundwater beneath the regional aquitard existed beneath the site until groundwater was recharged. So it appears that the board is relying on SEVWD production well data. We have an email from SEVWD yesterday saying they'll be providing the well log shortly. Unfortunately, Section 13752 of the Water Code does not have provisions that allow the release of production information. It seems that we still don't have everything that the board has, and we'll never get what has been relied on here, and we object to that. In terms of other arguments, I think if you, as I do, pay attention to what has gone unanswered as well as what was answered. You know, we heard just now, again, that, you know, this equipment was commonly known today. Okay, that's when it's commonly known. It was not commonly known in the 60s, and this question of knowledge of the discharge versus knowledge of the dry cleaner, I think you heard a lot that goes to the question of whether UATC knew there was a dry cleaner at the site. That's not the question. The question is whether we knew or should have known of the risk of dry cleaning contamination hitting the groundwater. That's the statute doesn't say that we're liable for causing or permitting a dry cleaner. It says for causing or permitting a nuisance, a discharge to groundwater that causes a nuisance. And UATC did not know or have reason to know of that. And I think that's very clear from the board's prior authority, and a big deal in terms of the precedent you're being asked to set here. I'm going to let Carrie respond on the groundwater issue.
Well, as we said earlier, I think there isn't a disagreement that there was a shift in groundwater gradient. I think all parties have indicated that. Earlier, there have been some figures that were presented by Moonlight's consultant that indicated that groundwater elevations were much shallower than what you've been told today. The data that were provided today were new and apparently not, at least not yet, available to us. I want to point out that the groundwater elevation information that they're talking about are from groundwater production wells that are half a mile from this site. And they are very deep. They're in a deep part of this aquifer. And they are not, I guess a question would be, is it possible for them to support the notion that the data for these deep wells a half a mile away are representative of conditions at the site, which is, you know, 400 feet from Saratoga Creek? So it's a very different hydraulic regime. So I think the question of the elevation of the groundwater table is key to our argument regarding whether you would have seen a plume. And based on what West had earlier displayed in a cross section, you know, the groundwater table was shallow enough such that a release from the ground surface, you know, would have gone down, and as the groundwater table came up, it would have generated a plume.
Thank you.
Through the chair. I'm sorry. I know we've already gone, but with your indulgence, may I just add one point to Diane, what Diane said? And
since you're the staff, yes.
Thank you. I just wanted to clarify for the record, because Mr. Rice thinks that the cleanup staff wants to name UATs merely because it permitted a dry cleaner on site, and that is not the case. We are saying that they are liable as a discharger because they had knowledge that PCE was being used on site and that it was a hazardous material that required careful handling and containment. So it's not just because they allowed operation of a dry cleaner.
Would you like to respond to that?
Well, I think that is what you're saying, though, because the statute and the case law is that you have to have knowledge of the condition. And knowing that a dry cleaner used dry cleaning chemicals is the same thing as saying you knew that there was a dry cleaner. And it's going to be the same thing, as I said, for doctor's offices that use mercury thermometers and for agricultural companies that use pesticides. You're taking this, you're reading out of the case law and the statute something that's very important, which is it has to be knowledge of the condition, not knowledge that somebody used chemicals or that it was a dry cleaner. Thank you.
All right. Would you like to take the opportunity to make some statements, a closing statement, or ask questions?
I'm just going to make a short closing statement just on the subject matter that's been touched upon by Mr. Reich and Ms. Wan. And I would Lori Gualco, attorney for Moonlight Associates, LLC.
This is being recorded, and some people who are listening to the recording won't recognize everyone's voices.
I apologize. I know on court call we always have to announce ourselves because otherwise no one knows who's speaking. And I would just refer the board back to our slide 11, in Ray San Diego Unified Port District, where it said that the State Water Resources Control Board has consistently taken the position that a landowner who has knowledge or should have known of the activity taking place and has the ability to control the activity has permitted the discharge within the meaning of Water Code Section 13304. That same type reasoning is in the Stewart case, which was cited by regional board staff, that because a lease provided petitioner would comply with all statutes and laws, that the petitioner had the legal interest in the property and they had the ability to contractually control that property through a lease. And at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Peter Krasnoff to respond to just a couple of the technical issues. Thank you.
Hi, Peter Krasnoff with West Environmental. I just wanted to address two of the technical issues raised by UATC's consultant. There is disagreement on the shifting groundwater flow direction. I think we showed that when you plot up the data using appropriate science, there is not the shifting groundwater flow direction that's been represented. The second technical issue I wanted to address is the use of the nearby water production wells. The data, elevation data, which has been available online and we've studied for a while, correlates very well with the rise in groundwater elevations that we actually see at the site, whether it's at the Chevron site or the Shell site or at our site over the years. So they are hydraulically connected. It is really good science. The actual rate of rise of groundwater elevations at the Chevron station, which is in the corner of the shopping center, mirrors. You can overlay the two graphs of groundwater elevation rise. They overlay perfectly. So they're definitely hydraulically connected. They are lower at this site, but not by much. So they are very useful data. So thank you.
All right. With that, may we have a staff recommendation?
Yeah.
Before a recommendation, I do have a question for the cleanup team, Moonlight Associates, in their comments pointed out that while the order spells out cleanup goals, that task 7 says recommend final remedial actions and cleanup levels. And I would ask for clarification of cleanup team's intention on that. Is should there be an interim cleanup goal identified, or is 7E, where it says recommended final remedial actions and cleanup levels, should that simply read remedial recommended final remedial actions?
Well, this is Stephen Hill with the cleanup staff of the Water Board. And we don't see a very large distinction here. We need some cleanup levels now because it will help guide the discharger's work to finish the tasks necessary to clean up this site. We have given them the option of coming up with site-specific cleanup levels as part of their cleanup plan, or they may decide that they're quite happy with these screening level-based cleanup levels that are in the tentative order before you today. So we think that the order is structured in such a way that they have the choice. And it's clear that if they do propose additional or site-specific cleanup levels, and we consider those and think they're reasonable, then we'll bring this order back and amend it, and those will be the new cleanup levels.
So,
in short, you do not think that there needs to be any word change?
That's correct. We think the order as structured addresses that concern.
Okay. Based on that, I think our recommendation is that the revised tentative order, that the board adopt the revised tentative order with the revisions to the due dates as included in the supplemental that's been given to you, that essentially clarifies where 2013 should be stated as 2014. And that is essentially based on at least the perspective that I see, that there's the parties have not brought up any question that PCE was used and spilled at this site. And while that's frequently at issue, really the Water Board's role then is, if PCE was spilled, to see that it's cleaned up and that beneficial uses are protected. And so cleanup team has recommended use of a 13304 order to do that, to push the cleanup. The order names discharges, but does not assign any level of responsibility to the discharge itself. And that is consistent with the approach we've historically taken at this board. So, as I say, with that, I'd recommend adoption of the revised tentative order with the date changes that are supplied in the supplemental.
I would so move.
Is there a second?
I second that.
Yes, we're going to have discussion now. Jim?
when I first heard and read the lengthy material from UATC, I thought it was a not unreasonable proposition that as a brand new development, sewer lines would be tight, the concrete would not have settled, the dry cleaning equipment would be new, and it may well be possible that it did not leak for a period of time. The question then becomes when. So I've listened very carefully and, as you know, asked a number of questions. I support the staff recommendation, and I'm going to tell you what I think is the compelling information that leads me to the conclusion that undoubtedly a discharge occurred during the period of time where UATC was the owner of the land. And hopefully energy will be spent on cleaning up rather than figuring out how much and an allocation, because that's a little bit of angels dancing on a pinhead. But here is what I find to be the compelling information. First, the west cross section, figure 2.3, shows groundwaters plus or minus 40 feet lower in the 1970s. So until groundwater had advanced to the point where it intersected with whatever material, whether it was DNAPL or aqueous phase in the groundwater, the staff's theoretical proposal that that material was sifting through the groundwater, moving its way through clay, is an entirely reasonable proposition and fits the facts. Second, and I think the most compelling, is there's a much larger plume, and it's shown in the West drawing, figure 3.1, and it's a substantially greater extent than the more limited area shown in the corresponding Erler and Kalinowski, I hope I pronounced that right, diagram. The moonlight presented in an analytical information estimating that groundwater plume as 750 feet in length, and using a assumption on movement through soil, calculated that it would take 46 years for the plume to reach that length. Now, I'm not going to say that I am compelled that 18.6 or 18 point whatever is a perfect estimate, but it could be off by 50%. But I am convinced that the length of time to create that plume is substantially greater than just somehow magically after 1978. And I think that's the most compelling. A couple of more points. I find the theoretical reversal flow, particularly the arguments about the well on the other side of the creek, unpersuasive. It's the nature of deposition of water-bearing alluvium in rapid sea level rise around San Francisco Bay that the alluvium would slope towards the creek. So on the other side of the creek, it would slope towards the creek or to the east. And without a compelling lithography that makes a distinction and shows exactly how the flow is, I find it not only easy to distinguish that, necessary to distinguish that. I disagree with the argument made by counsel for UATC on due process on the questions of groundwater. We don't need to know precisely the depth of the groundwater. We don't need to know precisely the relevance of perch water versus other water. They didn't provide information in the period between 1978 and 1990, yet the consultants for Moonlight did, which indicated groundwater was well below. Minor reversals of groundwater during this period of time, a rapid rise, are of no consequence in the larger question of, was there a discharge during the period of time? Should they have known? I perhaps I'm alone among the board members in knowing that when you rent land for profit to an activity known to be dangerous on a fire safety perspective, on an air quality perspective, on a worker safety perspective, it is not unreasonable to ensure those risks and perhaps even water quality. I do find that constructive knowledge, at least in the way I look at those things. The Clean Water Act passed in 1972. There was tenure on the property till at least 1975, and there was hot debate about the air quality impacts and the volatility. So I find these to be hazardous substances. I was well aware of them as hazardous substances at the time. So for those reasons, I find a discharge occurred. There was constructive knowledge, and certainly the equipment probably leaked more as time went on, and I leave it to the parties to work that out. Finding someone to be a responsible party does not allocate the relative level of responsibility. It just simply tries to get the necessary studies done so that work can be done.
Margaret, did you want to make any comments?
This was definitely a very challenging item. And in terms of, I guess I go back to the criteria for naming a responsible party, and I'm using the slide that was given. The three items here, own lease property at the time of discharge, I think from the science, and I admit I don't have a lot of background in this, but from what has been shown and discussed, I think there is a lot of evidence that shows that there was potential for or was discharge, possible potential for discharge at the time that UATC owned the property. I guess I really was stuck on this issue of, and it's number two, the knowledge of activities which resulted in discharge. This issue of, you know, do you, because you allow a dry cleaner to operate on your property, is that knowledge, you know, is that enough knowledge to be responsible and whatnot? But from what our legal counsel has advised us, the state water code states that. And, you know, I really struggled with this, and I guess, you know, I've learned that there actually was a change in the state water code to where it was before, this issue of, you know, knowing that something dangerous had occurred to just knowing that such an activity could occur. And that's where I really struggled with this issue, but it seems like it's pretty clear. And, you know, I'm going to say I don't necessarily agree with the water in the code because I think, you know, I look at other possibilities in terms of, you know, property ownership and what kind of liabilities that lead to. But it, that's what the code says. That's what the code says. So given that, and then item three, I think, you know, there is legal ability to prevent it. So it was a tough one for me, but I will have to say, because it's in the code, I will go ahead and support the motion. Yeah, it's unfortunate. I don't necessarily agree with it, but I have to go with it.
Nisha?
I think I also struggled with this a little bit. I think the science, personally, I feel the science does reflect that there was a release, there was a discharge, and I think there's enough evidence to support that. I also was struggling with this whole point of knowledge and how that works, and being a scientist, not a lawyer, it obviously is not my you know, best suit to comment about it, but, you know, based on the conversations we had, and I think I do also support where we are going with this, because, you know, the knowledge was apparently there. You know, there was a permit that does specifically state that there's a hazardous material being used in this operation, and you know, and there's evidence supporting that. So for me as well, it was definitely a challenging decision because I, in one hand, I do feel the science is there and it supports what has been happening. And the other hand, I've been trying to understand how does the naming really works and proceeds, like how we can proceed with this case. So I do also feel that we are in the right track, and thank you.
All right. Well, as you can all see, this board is not in the habit of just rubber stamping anything that comes before it. We've given very careful consideration to all of the testimony that was presented today, and for those of you who don't appear here very often, you should know that the board members also read these sometimes 6-inch thick packets, all for our $91 a month. So, and we appreciate you all coming and making presentations to us today. They were informative and enlightening. Like the other members of the board here, I looked very carefully at the three requirements for us to agree that we should name UATC as part of this order. And as far as the first one, which was addressed in almost all of the technical evidence, I considered it very carefully, looking at the nature of the activity, the equipment that was used, the chemicals that were used with that equipment, the historic hydrology of the site, and the monitoring results that we have. And I would conclude that the weight of evidence would indicate that the PCE discharge did occur before 1978, that there was a discharge during the time when UATC was either owned or was in control of the site. That's my conclusion from the evidence that was presented today. I also feel that the evidence meets the State Board standard that the UATC had the legal ability to be able to prevent the discharge. Like my colleagues, I was, struggling with the explanation that we got from our legal team, both the prosecution team and our advisory team, about what the standard is for the middle criterion, which is having knowledge of the activities that result in the discharge and therefore permitting the waste to be discharged. As I understand the legal advice that has been given us today and looking at the precedential cases, this case meets the standard that the State Board and the case law has set forward, and so that they did permit the discharge according to the definitions that we are being provided with today. And I recognize there was some legal discussion back and forth. I'm relying on the advice of, which I have too, of our counsel, Ms. Austin, and so I'm also going to support the staff recommendation. With that, I think we should have a roll call vote, please.
Board Member McGrath?
Yes.
Board Member Ajani?
Aye.
Aye. All right, so ordered. Thank you again for coming and spending your time.
We did get a copy of
the... Scott Reich for UATC. Will we be able to get a copy of the transcript from today's proceeding, and when will that be available? Okay, thank you. And how about the copies of the presentations that were made today? Will that also be made available? Okay, and then will there be a written order issued, or is our 30 days run from today? Will you issue the final order, or is that what just happened?
It's 30 days from signed order, and the order will be signed within the next couple of days. But
okay,
you'll have 30 days from that.
All right. Thank you so much, and thank you all for your time today.
Yeah. All right. We still have one more item on the agenda.
Well, actually, we have two. We have information item on the regional monitoring program, and we have
and
a closed session
closed
item
session
on the East Bay mud in the East Bay communities.
So fasten your seatbelts.
So I would recommend that we proceed with the information item at this point, and then we can more readily go into closed session to complete the meeting with East Bay mud. And so with that, I would invite, and I think they are here, our information item on the regional monitoring program is quite timely because not only did you hear this morning discussion about, during our pollution prevention item, the role of contaminants emerging concern, and the emphasis on that and the role of that in the upcoming State of the Estuary Conference. But this year, the State of the Estuary Conference includes the annual meeting of the Regional Monitoring Program, and the emphasis, again, will be on contaminants of emerging concern for that. So this is quite timely. Meg Sedlak is the program manager of the regional monitoring program, and the San Francisco Estuary Institute is contracted to manage and operate the program. And so she'll give us a description of that and note that this is 20 years of the program. So.
Yes, and I would like personally to thank you, Meg, for coming. It was in large part my idea to try to have actually routine information items from you folks at SFEI, because with the regional monitoring program is not the only example, but it's a big example of how your work informs and makes our work much, much easier and much better. And I'm so glad you were able to come and take this opportunity, particularly since we have two relatively new board members. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity. I think one of the things that was very interesting for my colleague Meredith Williams, who's our interim executive director, and Jay Davis, who's the co-lead on the program, is to see how the board implements these science decisions in a process. And one of the strengths, I used to work for a consulting firm similar to Earle and Kalinowski, and I think one of the strengths of the regional monitoring program is that we are a collaborative group where we have all of the parties at the table looking at the scientific information together and prioritizing what the management questions are and what the research should be. So I'm very pleased to be here today to have that opportunity to talk about some of the work that we've been doing in the RMP. So I'll start a little bit with an overview of the RMP, our genesis, talk a little bit about what we've accomplished, and then talk about some of the future directions that we're headed in. And Bruce, you gave a great introduction in terms of one of the key things that we're really interested in is chemicals of emerging concern. Our mission is to collect data and communicate information about water quality in the San Francisco estuary to support management decisions. We were the outgrowth of a former executive officer, Steve Ritchie, in 1986 when he was the executive officer. He was tasked with developing toxic standards as part of the basin plan. And when he went to look in the bay to see what ambient data was available, there wasn't any. And at the same point, we had done considerable upgrades to water treatment and wastewater facilities. At that point, we'd spent about $2 million. And again, there was very little data to say whether this had been successful in terms of the ambient health of the bay. So with that in mind, when Steve Ritchie looked at this, he went to all of the parties who were discharging into the bay, the dredging community, the stormwater agencies, the wastewater treatment plants, cooling water, and industrial facilities. And he said, we need to set up an ambient program that does regional monitoring that pools our resources. I'm willing to give some regulatory relief on this if you'll participate in that. So it was a novel idea in terms of it being part of a permit. It was also a novel idea in terms of structure. And I'd like to read what Steve said at our 10th year anniversary. He said, we have to force scientists and managers to meet at the table and to stay at the table together and to work at getting relevant information and using relevant information. That is the real key of the RMP and will continue to be a key over time. And I really think this is critical. It's critical for us in terms of science organization, and it's critical to us in terms of developing good policy. The other advantage of having this be part of a permit is that we have secure funding, which means that we're allowed to do long-term planning and to develop long-term multi-year plans with regards to allocating our resources. It also means that we can develop long-term partnerships. We are a model program, not only for other entities within the state, but across the country. So people often ask, well, what is the RMP? Who staffs it? How does it work? We are operate under a memorandum of understanding. The SFEI administers the regional monitoring program. SFEI, I put our mission station up, a mission statement up here, and you'll see that our mission statement provides science support for management of aquatic resources is very similar to what the goal of the RMP is. We have four programs: operations, clean water, resilient landscapes, and then the last one there is our environmental data information and technologies group. And I think this is really important because the issues that we're looking at the bay are very complex. complicated and multifaceted. So it allows us to draw from a number of different program areas as we need breadth and depth to address the issues facing the Bay. The Estuary Institute is about 50 people. We're largely scientists. 25% of us hold doctorates. 25% of us hold, in addition to that, 35% of us hold master's degrees, and 25% hold bachelor's in sciences. So you see that we're mainly scientists at the Estuary Institute. I also want to make you aware of the fact that we're a joint powers authority, so that's instrumental in terms of us being able to accept funding from the state and also to facilitate when there's a need, an information need, we have the ability to jump in. So I talked a little bit earlier about how Steve Ritchie had tapped a number of different groups, the wastewater community, the stormwater community. Each of these five groups that we have that are providing funding to the RMP have representatives that serve on our committees. So we have a steering committee and a technical review committee that meet quarterly. Again, those parties have representatives on them, and they're helping us to define our management questions and the goals for the organization. They're also giving us guidance and feedback. We also have work groups on select topics where we have external advisors, and I'm very pleased that we have a number of world-class experts on these working groups that come from Cal, they come from MIT, they come from Duke, and they're helping us to hone the science. But the key part is that the stakeholders are really helping to direct the research in terms of the answering, prioritizing the management questions and assuring that the type of research that's being done is helpful to those who need it. So how do we actually answer the management questions? We do this in two ways. One is through our Status and Trends program, which is our core program where we're out every year looking at some but not all of these constituents. We look at water, sediment, bivalves. We're looking at cormorant eggs, tern eggs, small fish, a variety of sport fish. We also conduct special studies, and the special study ideas are developed in our work groups and then come up through the technical review committee and the steering committee to assure, again, that they're meeting a management need. To give you an example of a couple of special studies that we've done recently, under the copper site-specific objective, there was some concern with regards to the effects of copper on the olfactory nerve of salmon, and we've been working with NOAA on that. We developed the scope of work for that. As well as another example would be polybromide diphenyl ethers, which are a type of flame retardant. The Bay Area has some of the highest concentrations in terns, and there was some concern about how this affected the hatchability and survival. And we sponsored a study, again, with a group out on the East Coast to look specifically at that question. So what have we accomplished? Well, we have close to a million data points in our web query tool that's a web interface that's available to anybody. I've given an example up here of the types of data that are there, and you can see that we have a myriad of data points there, very good spatial coverage, as well as in this particular example, which is polyaromatic hydrocarbons. You can see if you actually look at some of those individual data points, that will give you an average, and then we'll show the series over time. So we have spatial information as well as temporal. This information is also made available to CEDN, the California Exchange Data Exchange Network. So again, we're a regional data center, SFEI is, so that's another way that we are using the latest and greatest in terms of templates and working collaboratively with our partners across the state. So one of the things that our data is used for is looking at impairment of beneficial uses. Here I've given a graph of our most recent sport fish monitoring. I placed it in context of some of the other estuaries across the country. You can see that San Francisco has some of the highest mercury concentrations across the state. This is also above the TMDL target of 0.2, so we are showing some impairment there. The beauty of the RMP is that we not only provide data about one contaminant and one organism or one matrix, we provide a holistic look at it, which when you're working with something like mercury is really important because where methylation occurs and how methylation occurs is a function of a variety of factors. So we have information on water, we have sediment, we have small fish, we have large fish, we have bivalves, and we're looking collectively as a whole in modeling and thinking about that. And then we're synthesizing that information into things such as the mercury synthesis article that Jay Davis just completed with a number of his colleagues supporting that, and that came out in a peer-reviewed journal article. So one of the other strengths of the organization, I think, is that we're very good about disseminating our information. So we're publishing in technical journals. We had the best paper of the year last year in environmental science and technology. So we are recognized as doing good science, but we're also really keen on making sure that it's getting out there. So we go the full nine yards from technical journals such as ES&T to the Oakland Museum, where I don't know if any of you have had a chance to go over there, but the below the bay highlights a lot of the regional monitoring work, and it was really exciting to be involved with that and to be part of that, and I strongly encourage you, if you have a moment this afternoon, to jump over there and take a look at it, because the exhibit turned out really well. We also have convened workshops, and again, that harkens back to what Steve Ritchie said about trying to get scientists and stakeholders and decision makers all at the table. So we've hosted a number of mercury conferences. We had a nutrients conference 2 years ago. This year we're hosting one on tidal wetlands. And we have our annual meeting. And this year we're collaborating with State of the Estuary, which is very appropriate given that it's 20 years of the CCMP and 20 years of the RMP. So I think most importantly, and for those of us at the Institute, this is really important to us, we're providing science for informed policymaking. That means that our information is being used for decisions with regards to the wastewater NPDES permits. It's being used with regards to the municipal regional permit. It's being used with regards to dredging decisions. The RMP data was a foundation for the TMDL for mercury and PCB. We are collecting data with regards to site-specific objectives, such as the copper. And our data has been used when needed to look at phase-out or bans of certain types of chemicals. And just to give you a quick example of this type of information, in early 2000s, we as scientists thought that the bulk of contaminant load was coming in through the northern portion of the estuary. That's where the bulk of the flow, water flow, was coming in. 90% of the flow comes in through the north. And the thought was that 90% of the contaminants were coming in with that flow. I'm sorry, not 90% of the contaminants, but a significant portion. And depending on which contaminant you're looking at, the load's slightly different. But you know, the general philosophy was that the bulk of the flow was bringing in the bulk of the contaminants. What we found after extensive sampling is, in fact, that that's not the case, and that we see a much greater proportion coming from the urban stormwaters. And I think this is important in terms of if we're going to do effective management actions of really understanding the science behind it. I have a graph here of polybrominated diphenyl ethers. These are flame retardants. We, in the regional monitoring program, have an incredible data set on this. We started early in 2000 monitoring PPDs. And they were two of the three formulations were phased out in 2006, in part based on RMP's data. The third formulation actually is being phased out this year. And what we see here are our concentrations in bivalves over time. And what you can notice in the graph is that there's a declining trend. And this is true of all of our biological matrices that we're looking at, tern eggs, sport fish, et cetera. So again, we're providing the data that shows whether management actions are effective or not. So that raises the next question of, as we phase out PPDEs, what's next? I'm from the Midwest. Hockey is about as close as you can get to a religion there. I seek my inspiration from people like Wayne Gretzky. He says, a good hockey player plays where the puck is. A great hockey player plays where the puck is going to be. And that's the goal for the RMP, is for us to work in collaboration with the Water Board and the stakeholders to understand what future decisions you all need to make, and make sure that we are giving you the information that you need to make those decisions, so helping you to anticipate that. And an example of that is the chemicals of emerging concern. And this is a huge arena for us. I think many of you are familiar with pharmaceuticals and some of the studies that have shown feminization in surface waters. That's one example of the hundreds of thousands of chemicals that are out there. And unlike the Clean Water Act that lists 126 priority pollutants, and we can go pollutant by pollutant, we need to develop new strategies for looking at this. And the RMP's been involved in two areas of developing new approaches. One is bioanalytical tools, where we're looking at modes of actions and chemicals that operate on certain receptors, for example, endocrine-disrupting compounds. The second is to help support new analytical techniques that allow us to use the biota to understand what types of chemicals are accumulating. And we recognize that we cannot do this alone. We're a very small organization, and one of the pluses about the regional monitoring program is that we are developing relationships with academics, other institutions, both nationally and internationally, and leveraging what little funds we have to provide seed money or to do pro bono work. So the RMP is really leading the way on this. We recently, a state panel report came out on monitoring CECs in the state and recommendations. The RMP was listed as a regional monitoring program and as an exemplary program of that. We've developed a strategy for addressing CECs. We've prepared a synthesis of 10 years' worth of data that we've been collecting on some of the CECs, including the PPDs that I mentioned earlier. So just to give you an example about the types of alternative flame retardants, this was another project that we leveraged with US EPA. Actually, it was all done pro bono. And this is one of the ways that we really try to take the money that we're given in the RMP, the extra distance. And I apologize that it's kind of hard to see over there. But basically, the graph here is showing concentrations of a chlorinated phosphate that they're using as a substitute for BDEs to meet the state standards for fire retardancy. And the point that I want to show here is that the concentrations that we see of these phosphates are on par with some of the legacy contaminants, such as PCBs, as well as some of the things that we would consider emerging, the PPDEs. And some of you may, well, some of you look pretty young on the board. I'm showing my age on this one. Some of you may know TDCPP, that's chlorinated trist. This was in pajamas in the 70s. I vividly remember my parents pulling things out of my wardrobe and telling me I could no longer wear them anymore. Both TDCPP and TCPP are Prop 65 chemicals. They're carcinogens, they're mutagens. The other thing I wanted to draw your attention to is this year's Pulse. 2013 will be focused on chemicals of emerging concern, as well as the State of the Estuary RMP annual meeting. We're having a whole session on that. The other issue that's really near and dear to us and important and that we're devoting substantial resources to are the issues of nutrients. I think several of you know that the San Francisco Bay is a nutrient-rich estuary. It has levels that are comparable to what we see in the Chesapeake. But unlike the Chesapeake, we don't have yet, it may be on the cusp of changing, have yet to see some of the adverse impacts, such as the low DOs that cause fish kills and algal blooms. And work that we're seeing within, or work that's being sponsored by the RMP, is being done by USGS, has beginning to show that we may be in a regime change. So the graph on the left here is suspended sediment concentrations or particles in water, how turbid is the water. And what we see over the last 10 years is the bay is getting clearer, and meaning that there's more light penetration. And one of the concerns is that as we have more light, we may get more algal blooms. And the graph on the right is summer chlorophyll levels or algal potential there, showing that we are seeing a dramatic increase in the chlorophyll in the bay. So I hope I was able to give you a little bit of insight into the RMP and how we're trying to bring science into decision making. I'd welcome some questions, or feel free to send me an email afterwards.
Just to give you the opportunity to brag a little bit, the RMP was really the first of its kind program, and the Delta now has a copycat program, right?
Yes.
For the RMP. Why don't you talk a little bit about maybe other examples across the country who have been able
I'm glad you chose the Delta RMP. That's very near and dear to our hearts because, obviously, again, that's within the Estuary Institute, and we're very excited to have that happen. And exciting in terms of it being a forum to bringing a variety of groups, dispirited groups together to look at the science. The Klamath is also looking at a regional monitoring program. They have one that's operating out of Humboldt State. We've gone up there and talked to them about how we work, how we're set up. Lake Tahoe is another group. We present frequently at national meetings, and I will tell you every time I'm at a national meeting, they always come to me and they say, "Wow, that's really great. How do we do that?" And I think the kudos should come back to the Water Board for the foresight that they had to set up this program, because that we wouldn't exist without that. It's really phenomenal. So.
About 15 years ago, I had the good fortune to serve on a Pew Ocean panel with kind of many of the who's who in coastal management in the country and the first head of the Puget Sound Water Quality Authority. And to a person, they all had RMP envy. They all thought that this was something that was just absolutely incredible. And they're right.
And we actually have been in discussion with the Puget Sound in terms of their program and what we're doing in chemicals of emerging concern. So,
all right. Well,
thank you so much for the opportunity
for coming. I'm sure that your presentation is going to, you know, spark additional questions later on. But it's always, you know, it's always good to be reminded about where all this data comes from that we're able to rely on, so and never second guess. You know, it's high quality and useful, and all of the things that the RMP was designed to do. And we appreciate it very much.
Well, it's very much a two-way street, and we really appreciate working with the Water Board in terms of having them participate in each and every one of those steering committee, technical review, and the work group meeting. So it's great to have that collaboration in terms of helping us direct the science so that we're actually useful.
And I think it's important to note that in the Bay Area and Estuary, there's no question amongst the stakeholders about the science, that there's right. full reliance, and this is the basis. And so,
unlike today.
Yes. So, and emphasize the publication Pulse of the Estuary. I know we have some copies of prior years, but the 2013 version of that is going to be available at the
end. Mm-hmm.
Right. So if you don't have copies, and if you want copies back to 1947, no, not quite that long, but I'll also say that in the early years, the RMP, the data was always available, and it came out in about a phone book worth edition. Up until earlier this year. In fact, that was what was propping up my computer screen. But I think this, as Meg says, getting the message out has been key, and I would say that the Estuary Institute has done a magnificent job of being able to make the data much more approachable for the public and the stakeholders.
As we say, turning data into information.
Correct.
Thank you. It's, you know, having a good data is always a big challenge, so that's great.
Thank you all, and I guess
thank you, Meg.
Meg gave the presentation, but just while they're here,
yes,
Meredith is the interim executive director at the Estuary Institute, and Jay Davis is with the institute.
Jay Davis. I said, Jay Davis is Jay Davis.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
He's one of them fuzzy-headed scientists.
Yeah, indeed. So we're pleased they're able to come on over and be part of this. Yeah.
Thank you. To be continued. Appreciate it.
With that, the last item on our agenda is a closed session on the East Bay Mud, East Bay Communities. Since it is a closed session, again, we'll do the exercise of clearing the room except for the team that is part of essentially the equivalent of the prosecution team, which includes Yuri, Lila, Robert, our Deputy Attorney General, and myself. So, yeah, we'll as everybody vacates the room and all of that, we'll get this set up.